previously on Who Killed Amy Mihaljevic.
We immediately took this as a missing person report and acted that way. But it got more serious as it got dark and more people were contacted and nobody seemed to know where she was. So it got to be a little more traumatic, and then of course we involved the media to help locate her. And then we started our investigative process.
35 FBI agents were assigned to the Mihaljevic case. 100,000 man hours had been logged. Practically everyone involved in the investigation were clinging to hope that Amy would be found alive.
I'm John Walsh, asking for your help. If you've seen this child, Amy Mihaljevic, please call 1-800-THE-LOST. There is a reward.
So you're confident this guy is...
Well, apparently, we've talked about this, apparently a lot of people are confident. And he's on, he's not doing it for free. Somebody's paying for him to be down here like this.
Right.
And he was only supposed to have been down here for...
6 weeks.
6 weeks. Now we're going on 2 years.
I'd like to think maybe that's maybe what started Amy to go. The story is, you know, I'm trying to buy a gift to make my mother happy. So I think that's maybe where it started from.
That's how he got her comfortable?
Well, that's how...
Or she just...
She just wanted to go out of her way to try to make Margaret happy.
This quiet, upscale community is totally unaccustomed to this type of trauma. The Mihaljevic abduction is on the minds and lips of everyone in town. And authorities fear that with each day that passes, lessens the likelihood of her safe return. In Bay Village, David Lane reporting for the 10 o'clock news.
But whatever the explanation is, it's not simple, you know, so...
We picked up a number of items, the significance of which we're not sure of at this time, but all these items have been sent to our forensic laboratory in Washington, D.C., and we're awaiting word as to what, if anything, is of evidentiary value, and whether or not it fits or coincides with anything that we have previously developed in this case.
First couple of 4 or 5 days, you know, you spend 24 hours a day crying your eyes out and saying, why me, why my Amy? And I guess there is no answer to that question because this is proven it can happen anywhere, anytime. But after a while, you still cry.
Bay Village Police and the FBI have devoted over 100,000 hours while investigating over 3,000 leads in the case.
With Margaret leaving and... her passing, then I'm the only one left.
Welcome to the 16th and final episode of the Who Killed Amy Mihaljevic podcast, a Slow Burn Media LLC production. I am your host, Bill Huffman, and when I say this is the final episode, that does come with a caveat, as I do have some bonus episodes for you to look forward to during the hiatus of Season 1 to Season 2. After 4 months of podcasts and a year of investigating, I have to be honest and say that the answer to the question that this podcast posed of who killed Amy Mihaljevic still remains unanswered. Is there hope that technology will catch up with the killer and that they will one day be able to close this chapter? Yes. But unfortunately, this case is not simple, and therefore we will most likely not have a simple answer. Have you ever found yourself in a situation where you want an answer to a question more than anything, but there is actually no practical way to get it? I thought this podcast might be able to get some answers to some long-held questions. And really, I am more confused now than ever. The problem with Amy's case is the fact that it's 29 years old and there really has been no answers to what it was that led to her abduction other than the mysterious phone call. I mean, who can call 10-year-old girls with a ruse in place and convince them that they would be doing what was nothing more than some innocent trip to help their mom out? I mean, how does this person return to normal life on the October 29th, 30th, after murdering and sexually assaulting a 10-year-old girl? Who could manage to kill a child and go back to everyday life? Did they? With this being the 16th and final episode of the Who Killed Amy Mihaljevic podcast series, there are some important numbers to go over, because as we look back at Amy's case, there are a lot of questions that remain unanswered and why it has remained unsolved for 29 years. Let's start with the tips. 10,000 tips. 28 Christmases that Amy has been gone. 10,000 plus days this suspect has remained free. Over 100,000 man hours and counting have been devoted to this case. Millions of posters were distributed across the country and the world in 1989 and 1990. There have been over 1,000 suspect interviews. Hundreds, maybe even thousands of articles and news stories. Hundreds of thousands of downloads of just this podcast. 29 years of red herrings. Amy Mihaljevic's case has received a lot of local and regional attention. But when this case first hit the news due to the highly unusual ruse that was used in her abduction, there was another case that was already capturing the minds of America, and that was one of Jacob Wetterling. There was something about his case that the national attention brought that Amy's case never seemed to garner. And I'm not sure why that would have been, but Margaret was a fixture with Patty Wetterling on daytime television. She just didn't get the nightly news coverage like on a, say, Peter Jennings broadcast or NBC nightly news type of show. It just wasn't there. The coverage for Amy was strictly regional and local, despite all the efforts of the Amy Center and spreading the word that this girl had been missing for, you know, as many days as she was. The case just never did seem to attach itself to the national zeitgeist. And that is actually one of the things that is really cool about what's coming up with the documentary series on Investigation Discovery that will be covering Amy's case and a few other murders that occurred around the Lake Erie area. And I participated in this documentary, as well as James Renner, who you've heard on this podcast, as well as Nick from the True Crime Garage podcast. He's also been on this podcast as well. And we, you know, all believe that this case can be solved, and we do all have our own suspects. But, you know, when it boils down to it, it is one of those cases that until it is solved, you know, we will not rest. And I've attached my name to this case. James is attached. Nick's attached. And anybody that is, you know, looking for justice, you know, feel free to contact any one of us or the Bay Village Police or the FBI. But we all want justice. We all want the same thing. And there are a lot of people out there, the Amy Army, you know, there are people that really, really want to see this case solved. And it isn't just for the closure for a family, but it's a closure for a community and a law enforcement even that has been basically fighting a, you know, endless battle for nearly 30 years. So until this suspect is in handcuffs, I'm never going to say that this case is, you know, solved or anything along those lines. And you can garner your own interpretations from this podcast through the interviews that I've conducted, through the, you know, notes that have been associated with the shows. But, you know, again, these are my interpretations of what I'm experiencing. And if you have a different feeling on what the case has been and how you think it is going or where it's going or who you think may be involved. You know, we all want to know. So, you know, feel free to reach out at any point. And, you know, again, this is one of those cases that it really is going to be up to the public to bring the answer. And, you know, that's where we stand. So let's just go over some of the clips that we've played throughout the series and discuss some of the things that will eventually lead to the arrest and conviction of this perpetrator. When I met with Chief Spetzel, I did ask him if there was anything that would have counted somebody out, you know, sexuality or, you know, interests, and he had this to say about that.
Whoever we feel it has factors and circumstances that make them an interesting suspect, that's who we'll look at. That could be from the get-go, it could be thousands of people because they're all look-alike. It could be that we weeded it down to this many or this many. We don't dictate it by lists or numbers. It's just whoever's there, we're going to look at them. And we'll go by circumstances and facts. And we always let the facts drive it. With any kind of missing child, you kind of work out in concentric circles from the family. So you obviously, you talk to the family, you look at the family, you know, where were you, what was going on, you know, do all those typical things that you do that are very uncomfortable for a family when they're missing their child. They're grieving, they're distraught, and yet you're asking them questions that kind of, you know, would indicate that maybe they had some involvement, but that's part of the process. Not comfortable, but they have to be done. So really, you kind of had investigations going, looking at the family, and then you're following these other facts that you know from the friend of Amy's. Definitely, at least two, possibly three of her friends had information on this meeting that she was going to have after school with this individual to go buy a gift from her mother. In fact, they talked about that she had $45 to spend and she was going to go to the mall. So there's some pretty specific details within that conversation that she relayed to her friends.
True crime author James Renner has been an invaluable resource within this podcast as well as in Amy's case in general, because it was in 2006 that he brought the case back to the forefront of the media by his writings with Scene Magazine as well as his book on his search for Amy's killer. Now, James has his own theories on who this killer may be, but when I did sit down with him on numerous occasions, I did pick his brain and wanted to know how it was that this person was able to convince her to do this.
It's just bizarre in the sense that, well, one, how he was able to get her to actually go along with it,
mm-hmm.
and then two, the fact that he had tried it before with other girls.
Yeah, yeah. So that becomes, in my mind, the most important clue is he, before Amy's abduction, he was calling a number of other girls that were Amy's age, kind of looked similar in appearance. And these other girls were from North Olmsted, which is one township south of Bay Village. So the key to finding out the identity of Amy's killer is figuring out how the girls in North Olmsted intersected with Amy in Bay Village, because they must share some sort of habit, you know, of going someplace. And because this man, whoever he was, had to have known all these girls and had to have had a way to get their phone numbers. So there's a couple ways in which they do overlap. One of the ways is the Lake Erie Nature Center, which is in Bay Village.
Right.
The Little Nature Center. All these girls had visited the Nature Center in the weeks leading up to Amy's abduction. And at the time, there's a log book that the kids could go in and sign their name, number, and address in order to get on the mailing list. And some of these girls did that. So was he connected with the Nature Center? And did he see these girls walk in and get their numbers that way? Another way in which they're connected is by one of these top suspects who the police didn't even know about until after my book came out. And I fought to put a specific name in the book, and the editor didn't want me to put it in because he's like, this name only appears once. Do we really need it? I'm like, you never know what's important, so let's get it in there. And it was the name of Amy's riding instructor at Holly Hill Farms, which is where she took horseback riding lessons. And she had a very specific, kind of odd last name. And after the book came out, one of the girls from North Olmsted reached out to me, one of these girls who got the call from Amy's killer. And she said, that name of Amy's riding instructor, I had a male math teacher in North Olmsted, a male math teacher with the same last name. I wonder if they're related. And I looked into it, and sure enough, the girl who got the call in North Olmsted, her math teacher had the same last name as Amy's riding instructor. They were brother and sister. So he would have, you know, the thought is he had visited the stables where his sister worked and run into Amy there.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the case is a rabbit hole. I mean, obviously, like Mark said, and I agree, and you agree, that they wouldn't continue to pay Torsney the money that they probably are paying him a significant amount. I mean, it's the guy who caught Whitey Bulger. So,
yeah,
you know, he's not doing it for free. So he's got to be getting somewhere. And there's got to be something that he's got that says we're on the right track.
I would think so. Yeah. You know, another thing that I think the prosecutors and police might be putting, you know, rolling the dice on and what might be keeping them going is this things like this arrest of the Golden State Killer, you know, where we've got new ways of using DNA. And, you know, all these cases, these cold cases are being solved now by using DNA to track down distant relatives of the killer because they're able to get that mitochondrial, the DNA that's passed down through, I think the father's side of things. And so that gives you a spread of like, well, the killer's related to this group of people from, you know, Decatur, Illinois, or Indiana, wherever Decatur is. And so that gives you at least a place to search and people to talk to. And that's how all these cold cases are getting solved. So if they do have some sort of DNA from Amy's body, I think soon, and soon being like the next year, we'll be at a place where we'll be able to narrow down enough to figure out who this person's potential family was, and that'll give us an idea of which suspect to look at.
One of the most important interviews during this podcast has been with Special Agent Phil Torsney, who has since retired from the FBI but has been brought in on a part-time basis to assist with the Amy Mihaljevic case. He was one of the original FBI agents on Amy's case in 1989 and has been invaluable to assisting the investigation, and his knowledge on the case is remarkable, and this is basically my conversation with what I had to ask him.
Her father said that she wouldn't have ever gone with somebody that she didn't feel comfortable with, or at least didn't know. So it does beg the question on how many times and what he used to groom that comfort zone.
Right. You know, this case has had ups and downs, but you know, one of the things, at least she told somebody about that phone call. Otherwise, it's possible. I mean, she would have gone up to that shopping center if she had really kept it a secret, and we wouldn't have known her purpose in going up there. She told associates about the gift and the phone call. And, you know, we've obviously looked at cases which have a similar setup because of that, because Amy told people about that. If we hadn't known that, and that's why we still look at cases where there's missing girls or girls, young girls that have been the victims of homicide, where it's really unknown what led up to them being abducted, you know, whether it was just somebody who, you know, it was a spur-of-the-moment thing, or whether there's a planning process like we have here. And in this case, it's somewhat an unusual case in that there was prior planning like this. And we've talked to, you know, FBI behavioral people and a lot of people about that kind of thing. You know, the planning
in the prior contact, and you know, what the thought that this person put into this makes it somewhat different than the normal case, where, you know, a young girl is abducted and murdered. Yeah, I guess one of the important things here is just because something's been published through some media outlet, whatever it may be, it doesn't mean we're not looking in other directions. And we need additional information. It doesn't mean by the publication of that kind of thing and putting out names out there, we have additional information here in addition to what's been published. And we base our investigation on, you know, the facts we have. And a little thing that might not have anything to do with what's been published previously in regards to another tip, more information, or another suspect may add to the information we have here and have knowledge of that'll help solve this case.
Fair enough.
I'm not here all the time. But, you know, one of our goals, recent goals anyway, has been to get some nationwide publicity. We've had a ton of publicity here, you know, in the Cleveland area, Bay Village, Ashland County, Ohio. But, you know, it's possible that the individual who did this is living somewhere else. And there's maybe a similar case in California or Washington State, you know, Florida, that either a police officer might recognize from the past, or a victim, or a, you know, just somebody from another state that wasn't aware of all the publicity around here that's going to hear about this through, you know, this podcast or another sort of national.
Well, podcasts are international, so this will, even if he's overseas, he will.
Right, Canada, that kind of thing. Because, you know, this seems, you know, initially it seemed like it was somebody who has, no doubt, familiarity with Bay and you know, the rural areas southeast of here, southwest of here. But it doesn't mean a similar crime wasn't committed somewhere else and there's some officer somewhere who took a report on something like this. And that we keep looking at those cases throughout the country. We've accessed various websites or, you know, criminal kind of computer sites looking for similar cases with the gift and the phone call and the, you know, the age group of the young girl and that kind of thing. So, yeah, we're looking nationwide at this point.
Yeah, it also doesn't mean, he's not just living in the area still, potentially. I mean, he could be anywhere
people,
in the...
People move. He could have done this before, something similar before, could have done it afterwards, could have gone to prison for something like this for a period of time, therefore stepped out of the public eye or stepped out of the potential for getting caught during the time he was in prison. Maybe did 10 years, maybe did 2 years, maybe did 15, 20, got back out and started doing the same thing in another way.
24 hours ago, I found out the person that I'd been dating and seeing for the last 6 months as a con man.
That is my sister, Emma. Andrew Tonks' lies had been so convincing, she'd invested $300,000 with him. However, the tables were about to turn on Andrew. What he didn't know was that Emma had discovered his real identity. But to get any chance of justice, Emma had to act like it was business as usual. Coming up in this series...
And that's when murder, all this stuff goes through my mind. I'm really, really scared.
I'm assuming Sarah has watched too much Netflix and figures I've been defrauding you. Couldn't be further from the truth.
That's what this was, a real-life story that seems so unbelievable, but it was actually true.
A true story that all starts with one simple swipe to the right. I'm Sarah Ferris.
And I'm Emma Ferris, and this is my story, Conning the Con.
Well, this podcast is supposed to bring the attention that this case deserves, and hopefully it will help provide the publicity that you're looking for, and the closure that the community and the family
needs. Good.
So thank you again.
All right, thank you. What I don't want to do is limit it, say something that would say the way, because we don't know the answer to that.
Okay.
That would limit calls in on an individual. It could be a guy who's had prior sex offenses with young girls, but then it could be somebody who had a one-time opportunity and committed an offense. I'm not comfortable limiting it to that, because we want all that information. You know, we have some, you know, we have bait in the net to some extent. We have stuff out there we look at that's important. And, you know, we want information that somebody thinks is viable, and then we'll take it up and try to match it up with the multitude of, you know, intelligence information we have on file that might match something.
Throughout this podcast, you've heard from true crime author James Renner and his theories on the perpetrator on the Amy Mahalovic case. And I basically wanted to look back at some of the thoughts that he had on who may have been responsible for Amy's death and why it was that he thought this person may be the killer.
How old is Dean Runkle at this point?
I think he's like in his 60s, but he's stayed fit.
Okay.
You know? He's fit. But we're only on the tip of the iceberg here, you know, about reasons why, you know, it might be Dean Runkle. I mean, there's, you know, he was investigated a number of times, inappropriate relationships with students. He was found in parked cars alone with students. One of the reasons, again, that the police don't really like him for it sometimes is that, they've told me, they're like, look, we know he was into boys. You know, why would he be into girls too? And what they don't understand is, and what any FBI profiler would tell them, is if the adult's interested in prepubescent boys, there's no difference in his mind between boys and girls. It's only after they hit puberty that they would pick a boy or a girl. In their mind, if they're interested in prepubescent kids, it doesn't make any difference to them. And in fact, we know that a number of girls from his classes have contacted me and said that he used to touch them. Originally, it was a student who said, I think you should look at my teacher, Dean Runkle, from Amherst. And so I started looking into Dean Runkle. And
did he have any reason to, like,
he just always had a feeling that that he was involved. That back in 1989, when they released the composite sketch of Amy's abductor, this student saw the sketch and he said, "Oh, wow, that's my teacher. That's Runkle." And he told his parents and you know, he said, so look into this guy. But a lot of people look like the sketch, you know. But what is it about him that made him so interesting to the FBI? Well, it goes back to those women that were called from, well, they were girls at the time, in North Olmsted, that were called by Amy's killer. And one of the ways in which they were all connected was the Lake Erie Nature and Science Center in Bay Village. And the FBI agent that I spoke to believed that Dean Runkle had volunteered time at the Nature Center and would have been there to see the girls' names and phone numbers on that logbook, and to, like, kind of, you know, scope these girls out so that he could call them later and try this routine. And he actually called a woman that Runkle worked for in 1987. And she said, yeah, he was raising mice in the back of this convenience store in New London. And he would take the mice, when there got to be too many, he'd take them up to the Nature Center in Bay Village, and they would feed them to the snakes. You know, how's that as an image of a creepy dude?
Yeah, snake guy.
So I looked into his background, and it's very odd. First thing I found was that he grew up about a mile from where Amy's body was found in the middle of nowhere down in Ashland County.
And it is in the middle of nowhere.
It is. And if you're from there, you know that County Road 1181, where they found her body, is kind of the perfect place to dump a body because you can do it in the middle of the night. There's no houses around to see you. And if any car comes along, you're going to see their lights in the distance, and you have a good 3 minutes to get out of there and never be seen. So it's just – it's a perfect place. So you would almost have to be from that area to know that.
Yeah. What was it, 2007? Or no, it was 2008 when you and I went down there on the anniversary.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it is in the middle of nowhere.
You know what's funny is my memory is –
You don't even remember that?
I don't even remember that, man.
Yeah. So we met at Bay Square that day, and then I followed you down to County Road 1181.
Wow.
And you had a lot going on at that time. I mean,
I'm sure. I think that was around the time I was losing my job or something.
And I was about 5 weeks away from losing mine because I got laid off about 2 weeks before Christmas. No way.
That's so funny. Yeah, my memory is shot for, you know, anything that's not like the details of these cases.
Oh yeah.
Or you know, luckily the details of my family and kids and things like that.
Well, I have video of it, so if you want.
Oh, do you?
Yeah, I actually have to.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, so you'll be like, oh gosh, that. I don't remember that, but I guess I was there.
That's funny. So
Runkle lived, and
you lived right there, you know. And every day, Runkle has a compulsion. I believe he has several compulsions, but one of them is running and walking. He has to do it routinely every day. And his route was he'd do these like speed walking, even in the middle of winter, and it would take him down County Road 1181. Mm-hmm. People saw him every day, and so he was walking past that body every day.
Think he was a trophy?
I think he was just waiting for somebody to find it. And maybe, you know, and I'm not saying 100%. I want to make this clear. I'm not saying 100% that I know he did it.
Right.
I am saying 100% that Dean Runkle is a dangerous man. And that's because what I eventually come to discover is that he had been investigated by a number of schools for improper relationships with students. He wrote a note to this prepubescent boy that was in one of his classes asking for a blowjob. And this boy was kind of his special right hand, you know, teacher's pet type of thing for a while. It's real creepy stuff. He was originally
grooming.
Yeah, he's grooming. He was originally a teacher in Vermilion. And he taught there for, I don't know, 15 years or so. And then that's where he met this boy that he was grooming. And around the time that that boy became an adolescent, when he hit puberty, and kind of cut off the relationship with Runkle. It looks like at that moment, Runkle stopped teaching there. He also paid this kid. He put like $5,000 into an account for him. So he quits teaching and then wanders the country for 2 years. Before he leaves, he tells people that he's dying, that he's contracted this rare disease that he says he got from scraping his finger on a piece of coral.
With all the publicity that the Amy Mihaljevic case has received over the years, there was one thing that Special Agent Phil Torsney wanted me to convey to the listeners, and this was his words verbatim.
Yeah, I guess one of the important things here is just because something's been published through some media outlet, whatever it may be, it doesn't mean we're not looking in other directions. And we need additional information. It doesn't mean by the publication of that kind of thing and putting out names out there, we have additional information here in addition to what's been published. And we base our investigation on, you know, the facts we have. And a little thing that might not have anything to do with what's been published previously in regards to another tip, more information, or another suspect may add to the information we have here and have knowledge of that'll help solve this case.
You know, it is a very distinct curtain or whatever it was used for. It definitely looks like something maybe out of a hotel. you know, duvet cover, some type of...
Right, it has a distinctive, like, pattern to it from a bed cover. Look, maybe possibly originating from a bed covering, and we're still looking for somebody to recognize that.
Right.
At least the transformation from a bed covering into a curtain. And it looks like it was cut down to a specific size, you know, to cover a certain area, maybe a doorway or maybe a opening in a vehicle or a truck or something possibly on a farm, a barn. So, yeah, I appreciate you putting that up there. We all do. And if you can, if somebody recognizes it and can let us know what they think about it. It only, all these things, it just takes the right person, and I've said this before, to see it. And just because we've put it up before doesn't mean we shouldn't put it up again and get more publicity on it, and that's what we're trying to do. So the curtain is more distinctive than the blanket, but it was two items found in that field, and good possibility Amy was wrapped in something, and those are the logical items that we're aware of at this point.
And both blankets had the same similar canine hairs.
Right.
Okay.
They're similar hairs.
And you have had leads or tips come in regards to that particular item.
Yes. Yes, and we follow up on, some are better than others, and some are good. We follow up on, we get calls we follow up on. You know, the thing that scares us is this guy, you know, there's a chance he's still out there and doing the same kind of thing, and he's probably, you know, the logical step to contact girls of this age now is through the internet.
When I met with Chief Spetzel, I asked him whether or not it was important to him whether he was the one to make the phone call to Mark Mihaljevic when the perpetrator of this crime was actually in custody and finally going to face justice.
And I don't have any personal stake in it that I have to do it. I just want somebody to do it. I want somebody to be able to call Mark and say, we think we've got the guy, and we're going to put some closure to this, and we're going to get this done. I don't care who it is. It doesn't matter to me. I just think he deserves that kind of closure. The community deserves that closure. And again, the guy needs to be locked up. It's the bottom line. You know, as we sit here today, we don't know if this individual is alive. We don't know if he's dead. We don't know if he's locked up in prison. We don't know. But we certainly want to find out. So however that happens, whoever does that, I got no personal stake in being the one to do that, certainly. I just want it done. And I think, you know, you've talked with Mark. He's a great guy. He deserves that. Family deserves that, and we deserve to get this thing closed up.
So it's been 29 years since the abduction. You know, how do you see this case being solved?
I see it being solved through information provided by the public. I really do. You know, we have a vast amount of information, some of which we can piece together, some of it we can't. So I'm really of the belief there's someone out there who has direct or very closely direct information about who did this. Either they heard something, it's a relative, somebody confided in them, you know, deathbed confession, something, someone out there other than the killer knows what happened. That's the person we want to come forward, because then they'll be able to provide some clarity to all this information we have. We can, you know, we can put it together and make a case. I think that's how this is going to happen.
It's hard to imagine that there will be any sense of closure if the killer is actually ever apprehended. But I did have to ask Mark Mihaljevic how he felt if that was the case.
That's always been, we talk about that a lot. We think they're getting closer. We think they're getting closer. We don't know. That's always our carrot in front of our face, you know, that they're getting close.
And on that note, we are wrapping up Season 1 of Who Killed Amy Mihaljevic. I would like to thank the Mihaljevic family for allowing me into their home to discuss this sensitive matter. I'd also like to thank the Chief of the Bay Village Police Department, Mark Spetzel, retired Special FBI Agent Phil Torsney, Nick from the True Crime Garage podcast, Angela, who shared a very personal story about what happened to her in 1989, Amy's friend Christy Gibbons, and true crime author James Renner, who has been an invaluable resource to this podcast and has given many hours to not only helping with this show, but helping investigate the case in general. A large amount of questions regarding Amy's case remain unanswered, and obviously the most important being that of who was responsible for her death. This podcast set out to answer that question of who killed Amy Mihaljevic, and I've let the listeners make their own conclusions on whom they believe may be responsible for Amy's murder. There have been moments where one suspect looks like he has been the guy, but next thing you know, you hear from her father that one of the top suspects has apparently been ruled out. The truth of the matter is there is nobody in custody and nobody that the authorities have named as a person of interest. I am in this to the end, so I will say it's the end for now. If there are updates and new information, I will be right there with a new episode to add to the series. Amy's case will never be closed until the killer is prosecuted and put behind bars for the rest of his life. I will be back for a second season of Who Killed in early 2019, and you can follow me on Twitter at BillHuffman3 for any new updates regarding season 2, as well as Amy's case, as I will continue to update my listeners as well. Thank you again for listening to the Who Killed Amy Mihaljevic series. I appreciate all the kind words and the hundreds of thousands of downloads, and hopefully with this little bit of attention, this case will be eventually solved. But if you've enjoyed this independently produced podcast, please help support independent journalism by clicking on the donate button on the bottom left on whokilledamymihaljevic.com. You can also make a donation through the Venmo app with my username at bill-huffman-3. Thank you to the listeners that have helped keep this podcast going, as any amount is appreciated. And you can also help support the show by leaving a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts that will also help keep the show in the spotlight. If you have any information regarding this case, please contact the Bay Village Police Department at 440-871-1234. And the FBI is still offering a reward of up to $25,000 for any information leading to the arrest and conviction of the individual or individuals responsible for the death of Amy Renee Mihaljevic. So anyone with information concerning this case, please contact the FBI at 1-800-CALL-FBI. Thank you again so much for listening to the Who Killed Amy Mihaljevic series. And to all my listeners, be safe.
So when the scammer uses the hypnotic method of building rapport, then they create dysfunctional, delusional reality.
That's how a scam begins. Convincing the mark that it makes perfect sense to hand over their money to a con artist. The Scams and Cons podcast tells you how scams are run. You'll hear how people are convinced to buy fake art, buy machines that print money, or steal your house.
I get a phone call from my wife, and she let me know that they had decided to move all our stuff out. I could no longer do anything about it except go through an eviction.
And you'll hear it from the experts, people who run the cons.
So we go to your bank, you go in and get 6,000 cash, give us each 3,000, we give you this. Uh-huh. You go home, and what you find out is cut up newspaper.
It's fun to know how the trick is done, and that's what Scams and Cons is all about. Listen at scamsandcons.com. Or wherever fine podcasts are found.
3 a.m., the comedy horror podcast that holds weekly gatherings around the campfire. Let me tell you what you're going to get. You're going to hear stories about demonic possessions, prison stabbings, skinwalkers, glitches in the Matrix, cult leaders, missing 411, night marchers, Operation Paperclip, Mesopotamian devil worship, and so many monsters it'll give Kanye West a runaway for his money. Pop and meme culture also aren't off topic. a camp where laughs and scares are constantly competing for first place. We're just a group of friends trying to bust each other's balls, find the best stories, and expand the circle in the process. 3 a.m., the comedy horror podcast, not for the faint or fragile of heart. Let's go.